From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The John Moss Federal Building in downtown Sacramento was largely shut down last week after several suspected detainments at immigration court. At least 8 people were reportedly detained, and a protest broke out on Thursday outside of the building after a man was seen being taken by plainclothes agents. Access to the federal building was restricted shortly afterwards and continued on Friday. We had a Cap Radio reporter inside the courthouse as some of this unfolded last week. But in the days since, our multiple requests to ICE and Homeland Security have gone unanswered. Now, a local lawmaker is demanding answers and voicing concerns about what led up to the near total shutdown and the presence of ICE in and around immigration hearings. Democratic Assemblymember Maggie Krell represents Sacramento. Over the weekend, she sent a Freedom of Information Act, or a FOIA, request to the Department of Justice seeking more information. Welcome back to Insight, Assemblymember.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Good afternoon.
So when did you begin to learn about what unfolded last week in downtown Sacramento?
Well, I had been following, you know, the protests and, of course, anything related to constituents here in Sacramento, their family members, is something that we take very seriously. We had gotten actually constituent calls and inquiries about what's happening generally with the raids of immigrants. So this is an issue that's been on my radar for a long time. But then specifically reading, I think early Saturday morning, about what happened Friday and a shutdown of the courthouse, which is normally open to the public, I found that pretty alarming. And that is when I decided to write out a few Freedom of Information Act requests to the Department of Homeland Security, to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and to a branch of the Department of Justice that I believe, you know, may have been part of this type of decision.
Yeah, that immigration courthouse, it was closed to the public, as you mentioned. It was only open for appointments. And even at one point on Friday, even the cafe in the federal building was also closed as well. So it was largely locked down to the public. I think it's important to also mention that prior to becoming a newly elected lawmaker, you've worked as a prosecutor, you represented Planned Parenthood, you served in the California Department of Justice. How has that shaped your views and your response when it comes to immigration and immigration enforcement?
Sure. I mean, the courthouse has always been a building that's open to the public. And part of that is, you know, in the criminal context, under the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, defendants have a right to a public jury trial. And so then, you know, the public cannot be shut out of courtrooms unless there's a very specific security reason. And then the Seventh Amendment, which, you know, governs civil cases, which immigration does kind of fall as a quasi civil type of administration, also has some public access based on the circumstances, and specifically with respect to immigration, they are generally public hearings. There's a United States Code of Regulations on it that gives very specific reasons why they can be closed off. And I think it's important to ask what those reasons are in this case. And, you know, just to, you know, just to put a finer point on it, I mean, we're talking about families that are being separated. We're talking about kids watching their parents getting taken away. We're talking about workers in our community who show up at their immigration appointment and instead of getting a hearing, they get arrested in a hallway. These are pretty alarming things to have happen. And when you take the extra step of removing the public from even being able to watch, I mean, my understanding is that reporters weren't even allowed in and volunteer lawyers weren't even allowed in. So, you know, to take those steps, you know, you have a question about whether due process exists. And now you have this added layer of a lack of public transparency. And I think it's pretty alarming.
Yeah. A Freedom of Information Act, a FOIA, it's a federal law. It allows any person to request access to federal agency records. What specifically are you requesting?
Well, what I'm trying to do with this first FOIA is just get a handle on what possible justification might exist for the decision to lock down the courthouse. If there were security risks, if there's something else that I, you know, may not know about, that we may not know about, to get that information. So I'm asking for directives that may have been sent through agencies, communications between the staff at the courthouse that was locked down and other federal agencies, just so that we can have a better understanding of what exactly happened and why.
Have you heard anything yet?
I have received confirmations of receipt. And, you know, I expected this. I don't expect a quick response on this, knowing the federal government. You know, I know that this will take time. Typically, they have 20 days to respond. I will be following up. In my experience, sometimes, you know, you send in a letter and you find out you sent it to the wrong agency. And so you send it to another agency. One of my letters, I received confirmation, but that it needed to go, you know, into a public portal. So I've, you know, now registered the information into the public portal. So, you know, I expect to follow some steps here. I look forward to having a conversation with the right person to get this information, but I plan to follow up and do everything I can to get answers for our community and figure out what's going on here.
Given that you're a former prosecutor, currently a prosecutor, but also a state lawmaker, is filing a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act, was that an instinctive move on your part?
Maybe it was an instinctive move. I think what was instinctive for me was just my antenna really went up when I read that the courthouse was closed to lawyers and reporters. To me, that is a new level of troubling. When people in power are, doing something so serious as arresting a person in a hallway of a courthouse, taking away somebody's access to their lawyer, holding people in cells, avoiding the public. I mean, those are really alarming things. And I think we're all figuring out, where we fit into this fight, basically. And, you know, I'm thinking about it from, well, let's get the information and let's try and at least get due process for these folks.
As I mentioned, we had a CAP Radio reporter who happened to be at the courthouse. And when it was closed off to the public, he was already inside. So he was able to witness what appeared to be these detentions of people leaving their hearings by what appeared to be agents who are not wearing uniforms and whisking someone off away. But our multiple attempts to get more accurate information in the days since from ICE or Homeland Security has gone unanswered. Have you heard anything in terms of actual specifics about how many people might have been detained last week?
Not from the requests that I made. I did receive some information from some of the volunteer lawyers that were there that estimated, I think, that there were 8 arrests. And there may have been more arrests on Monday. I've also heard that the courthouse was shut down again on Monday and only certain people were being allowed in. So I do plan to follow up on that. I want to add something that also, informs what I'm doing here. I served as a volunteer lawyer the first time Donald Trump was president. When he was first separating families at the border, I actually went to Texas and what I experienced was eerily similar to what I'm seeing now. It was a very isolated detention center. I wasn't allowed to bring anyone in, wasn't allowed to bring a translator in, had to take off literally my earrings, put them in a locker with my phone to get access to my client. Originally, when I got there, I couldn't access the client because she hadn't signed something that she was my client, but I had no way to get her anything. So I had to jump through a lot of hoops, and it took hours, which turned into days, just to have a basic attorney-client meeting. And the way that she was so isolated and so alienated, and by this point, she had been separated from her 5-year-old son for a month, it really struck a chord with me. It was just, so unjust. And the deck was just so stacked against her and every other family that experienced what she experienced. And what I'm seeing now is very similar. I mean, we have these folks, and in some ways it's worse. We have these folks who have been here, some of them for more than 10 years, working in our community, living in our community, going to school altogether. I mean, these are our neighbors, and we're seeing them be terrorized by a federal system that is really trying to sweep things under the rug. And I think our best defense here is really, transparency and due process, and shutting down courts denies that. And so I think that's where you know, my instinct is really that we need to fight back on this.
You shared that experience as an attorney at the border during the No Kings rally at the state capitol on Saturday. You spoke to the crowd. CHP estimates there were more than 7,000 people fanned around the state capitol. Of course, there were dozens of other rallies that were taking place across the Sacramento area as well. And when you spoke alongside State Senator Angelique Ashby, you spoke with the experience as an attorney, as you just laid out, as a prosecutor against the immigration enforcement by the Trump administration. For those who support the president's actions and believe that this is the right course, some who are your constituents, what do you say to them?
I think we need to be a lot more strategic about immigration enforcement. Look, I mean, I don't think there's anyone who thinks that our current, system is working. Clearly, we need bipartisan efforts for immigration reform. I think we need to bring all solutions to the table, and this needs to be something that Republicans and Democrats work together on. I mean, everybody, you know, being in their corners, you know, hasn't worked on this, isn't working on this. So I agree with my constituents to that extent. But as a person with a career in law enforcement, you know, prosecuting the worst of the worst, human traffickers, drug traffickers, money launderers, transnational gang organizations, I can tell you that law enforcement has done a ton of work to build trust in vulnerable communities, in immigrant communities. And these ICE raids are really undercutting those efforts quite quickly. I mean, people are scared to go to their jobs. That means that victims of domestic violence will be scared to call 911. That puts people in a really dangerous and vulnerable situation. And if we want to, you know, get back to a place of public safety in California and anywhere, we need to establish that trust with law enforcement in the community. And ICE needs to be part of that by not doing these indiscriminate raids where people are scared to go to their jobs, where people are scared to go to their check-in appointments. I mean, it's literally a catch-22. If you do not show up at your removal proceedings, you can be removed. And if you do show up at your removal proceedings, apparently you can be detained and taken away from your family right then and there.
You mentioned that they have 20 days to respond to your FOIA request. In the event that these federal agencies don't respond or you're dissatisfied with the response, what's the next step?
Yeah, I mean, I expect there to be, you know, some haggling here on this. I'm hoping to have a conversation with the right person. If it takes, you know, 30 days instead of 20 days, I understand there might be some information that's security information and it needs to be redacted. Those things are reasonable. They happen all the time. If push comes to shove and we haven't received any information or our questions are not answered or we don't feel like we've gotten what we're entitled to, you know, under Section 552, which governs the FOIA, and the next step would be to file a lawsuit in federal court to enforce the FOIA.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento Assemblymember Maggie Krell about her recent request seeking information about the shutdown of the federal building in downtown Sacramento last week following suspected immigration detentions. The last few minutes we have you, I want to turn to other pressing government issues. It has not been a dull moment, of course. The legislature passed a state budget last week on Friday. How do you feel about the cuts and the compromises that had to be made to close a $12 billion shortfall?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really difficult budget year. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that before, but there's really no way for me to overstate that. I mean, the California budget was volatile in the first place. And then we were hit with the wildfires that are, you know, costing billions of dollars. And then, you know, the federal administration, the tariffs, the other threats and federal funding cuts, the potential cuts to Medicaid. I mean, all of that puts California in a very difficult, budget situation. I think what we got to was a compromise that attempts to protect, you know, critical government services, critical programs, and, you know, the salaries of our public servants, of our, you know, CHP officers, our firefighters, key services. But it's a budget that was really difficult to get to, and it's still being negotiated with the governor. And there's still, you know, a lot of question marks.
Given that this deficit is expected to grow in the coming years, this deficit isn't just isolated to the upcoming fiscal year. And what has been agreed upon or approved by the state legislature, I mean, obviously it's not final. As you mentioned, negotiations are still going on, but it does rely on a good amount of borrowing in addition to some cuts. Do you see this as kicking the can down the road, given that more shortfalls are projected in coming years?
I mean, I think it is a little bit of kicking the can on the road. I mean, we're in a critical moment where we're needing to borrow. I think the long-term solution is that we really need to look at, you know, where we can consistently cut back spending, but also how we can grow our economy. I mean, I think in California, we do have a lot of opportunities to continue to grow our economy, you know, certainly in the agricultural sector, in the tech sector, in the health sector. I mean, this is still, you know, the land of innovation, and there's a lot that we can continue to do. But that, you know, we need investment for that as well. I mean, our green job investments, our green tech investments, all of that is really important. And, you know, I think the most important kitchen table issue for folks, and the budget sometimes, you know, doesn't cut to the heart of this, but it's just the affordability of life for everyday Californians, you know, how much we're spending at the grocery store when we're getting our groceries, how much we're spending on childcare when we need to have someone watch our kids, you know, how much we're spending on housing. I mean, all of the basic costs of living continue to rise. And so, you know, I think that every bill I vote on, frankly, I think about that, you know, what we are doing. Are we making things more expensive? Can we make things less expensive? And I think that is a very real issue for us.
I'm happy you brought that up, because at the start of the year, legislative leaders said that they wanted to make affordability a priority in terms of legislation and policy. But there doesn't seem to be much traction or a solid plan months later. Has it been a challenge?
It's definitely a challenge. I mean, I think it ties into the greater economic challenges that we're facing, like I said, with the tariffs, you know, the instability of the revenues, you know, the budget situation, the wildfires. I mean, all of that, you know, kind of interplays. So, yes, I mean, there's not a silver bullet bill that we could all vote on right now to make California more affordable. But what we have really dug in on is housing and how we can reduce barriers to building more affordable housing. And now I think some of the bills that my colleagues have brought, you know, to streamline permitting, for example, to, you know, lessen some of the burdens of CEQA and under certain circumstances strike the right balance there.
I do want to touch upon some headlines that you drew last month. Time really does fly. This was several weeks ago. When you're a freshman lawmaker, you departed, some would say, defied Democratic leaders when it came to a bill that would pass harsher penalties for soliciting sex from 16 and 17-year-olds. Ultimately, you prevailed. It is moving forward. How do you reflect on that public disagreement with leaders in your party? Were there learning lessons from this?
You know, my focus always was and always has been this policy that when grown men are buying teenagers for commercial sex, that is a serious crime and it ought to be treated as a felony. And so that's been my focus from day one. I'm glad we got to where we got to. I mean, I come at this from, you know, knowing these survivors. You know, I've worked with victims for many years. Some of the victims that I worked with 15 years ago now are survivors, you know, running their own organizations and doing this work. And I know from them that it is critical that we focus on what's driving the sex trafficking industry, which is demand. That's the buyers who are really getting away with a slap on the wrist, if that. So increasing those penalties is really important. The bill also had other important features in it, like creating the first ever fund to help organizations that are doing the difficult work of pulling people out of sex trafficking. And by the way, that fund, you know, wasn't based on any taxpayer dollars. It was based on charging $1,000 to the buyers who are convicted of crimes related to purchasing commercial sex. So I think it's a really important policy. It's a change that I think is important. Number one, focusing on victims and their needs. And then number two, focusing on demand. So, you know, I'm sorry it looked ugly in the headlines, but I'm glad we're moving it forward.
There were some concerns among colleagues in your party that the way it was written, that it could be weaponized to target interracial relationships, same-sex relationships as well, perhaps between an older teenager and a younger teenager. How did you weigh those concerns as you were working on this policy?
Yeah, I mean, there was never any part of the bill that applied criminal penalties to anyone under 18. So this is about adults and minors, and 18 is the line for adulthood. But really, you know, I was looking at it from the standpoint of the kinds of cases we're seeing, and we're just not seeing older teenagers buying sex. We're seeing older men buying sex. So that is what we were addressing.
Assemblymember Krell, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maggie Krell is the Democratic Assembly member representing Sacramento. Assemblymember Krell has put in a Freedom of Information Act, a FOIA request to federal agencies following a near total lockdown of an immigration courthouse in downtown Sacramento last week, where several people were reportedly detained following their hearings. Up next, a new report on Lake Tahoe's clarity shows little change in recent years. We'll find out if that's a good or a bad thing for those who are studying it. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.